You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from London and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme... Despite an alleged truce last night, today has been the bloodiest day of fighting in Kiev since large-scale protests began in November. Journalists Robert Fox and Ivor Gabor will join me to discuss that and the rest from our pick of the day's news. Then we'll be changing tack and continuing our series on Italy. Today we talk defence.
Of course, being an Italian aircraft carrier, you have a pizza maker on board, so you get that feeling of being in Italy. There's several bars people can pull up to and have a coffee standing there and chatting away and sipping espresso.
All that, plus we'll review some of the week's best new books and pop over to Madrid's art fair. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. Lots coming up then in the next 60 minutes, but ahead of all that, the latest news with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. EU foreign ministers have held an emergency meeting in Brussels and agreed imposing sanctions on those responsible for violence in Ukraine as the number of people killed this week rises to at least 67. Some reports from those close to the demonstrators place the death toll higher. Pictures from the capital Kiev show police and demonstrators exchanging fire, with many bodies seen lying on the ground. President Viktor Yanukovych had announced a truce late on Wednesday, but violence reignited earlier today. EU foreign ministers have also discussed imposing an arms embargo on Ukraine. Among those attending the meeting were Didier Reynders from Belgium and Sweden's Carl Bildt.
It's an extremely serious European situation. I mean, this could go in the most awful, of even more awful direction that it already had.
It's possible to freeze some assets of some members of the regime. It's also possible to organize a visa ban or some restriction for the movement in the European Union. So we need to do that to push pressure and to try to open a real dialogue in the country.
The governor of Nigeria's central bank has been suspended by the president after questioning the whereabouts of $20 billion in oil revenue. Nigeria's state-owned oil firm dismissed Lamido Sanusi's claim as unsubstantiated. His threat to expose alleged corruption in Nigeria's oil industry is said to have irritated the president, Goodluck Jonathan, who asked him to resign 2 months ago. A military commander from the Alawite minority has been shot dead in the Lebanese city of Tripoli. He was gunned down on his way to work, according to security sources, in the latest violence linked to the Syrian civil war. Security forces continue to confront demonstrators in several Venezuelan cities in protests that have seen 5 people killed in the last week. The demonstrators, mainly students, blame the government for violent crime, high inflation, shortages of many products, and the alleged repression of opponents. The trial of 20 journalists has been opened and adjourned in Egypt. They're charged with aiding members of a terrorist organisation. They're accused of dealing with members of the Muslim Brotherhood, the party of former leader Mohamed Morsi, which is now banned in Egypt. The case will be heard again on March the 5th. Iran has agreed the framework for further talks with world powers on its nuclear programme. It follows 3 days of talks in Vienna, but one Iranian official said the two sides are still far apart on a final resolution of the dispute. Iran agreed last year to curb its nuclear activities in return for a partial lifting of sanctions, a deal that's only due to run for 6 months. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, says the meeting in Vienna gives them cause for optimism.
We've had 3 very productive days, during which we've identified all of the issues we need to address in reaching a comprehensive and final agreement. There is a lot to do. It won't be easy, but we've made a good start.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24. Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.05, which makes it 13.05 or thereabouts in New York. Now, despite last night's announcement of some sort of truce, the situation in Kiev does not appear to be improving. Medics working amid the protesters barricaded in Independence Square claim that 60 have been killed today, a figure which seems depressingly plausible. Ukraine's Interior Ministry, meanwhile, reports that 67 police officers are being held hostage. We have this from Natalia Gumenyuk, who's a Ukrainian journalist and co-founder of Hromadsky, a web television station created last November to show the protests.
Some know that there is this protest camp in the Independence Square, and there people were trying to protect by the fire shield for the last 24 hours or a bit more. And there was some strange movement in the morning, then the police and the riot police moved back, and some people went further, and they started to go up. And then they started to kind of go up, and there is a video of, and we've seen the snipers started to shoot the people, and the snipers were shooting at the hotel. There is a big hotel, a famous one, on the top of the square, where there are a lot of media, and the people were shot there. And in the Independence Square, there are a lot of corpses now, and there are a lot of medical, the people, the doctors, volunteer doctors, well-organized, but who tried to help the injured, but they also were under fire. I think that's the worst, and we don't really see the sign of a ceasefire at this moment. There is also information, because there are special police like the riot police, and also the kind of inner forces, the usual police. And we know that some people from the usual police like gave up, and they told that they would take a side of the protesters, and also there is a risk that they can be threatened. So this is a very insecure situation at the moment.
That was Natalia Gumenyuk of the web TV channel Hromadsky. Well, joining me now with their take on the day's events are Professor of Political Journalism at City University London, Ivor Gaber, and Defence Editor for London's Evening Standard, Robert Fox. Robert, to you first, at what point does what's happening in Kiev stop being a violent protest and start to look like perhaps the beginning of something much more serious?
It's a jacquerie. It's a spontaneous explosion. It is something both very old and very new. And this is why I think external powers, including Mr. Putin now, is finding it very, very difficult to grasp this one. Because as we were reading across the agencies today, it's not just Kiev, 45 million people, but ethnically, it is pretty diverse by European standards, the Ukrainian population. And it's how you get a handle on it. And the thing that I find, following from your question, really disturbing is that I find the pronouncements, whether of the EU, Catherine Ashton, they've sent foreign ministers in, it seems to have got absolutely nowhere, there's no traction. And even the various pronouncements of, you know, not quite red lines, but, you know, there are things he will be on the point of tolerance that Mr. Obama has said, yes, but what are you going to do? And the one thing that despite the pleas from some of the protesters, as they feel that they're coming under pressure or under fire of some kind of outside intervention, I see absolutely no chance of it. So what I fear, particularly from reports like the one that we've just had from Kiev, I think that violence will escalate before it gets to a critical point, before you get people getting together and saying, well, we must do something about it. But it's very interesting. The agencies, the most important alliance that is being invoked in this, the EU, the Russian Federation, actually, as things stand now, they can't do very much.
Ivor Gaber, the similar sort of question to you, I guess. And what Robert says is, it's obviously the case that people are saying the usual sorts of things that they say in these situations, urging restraint, good behaviour by all concerned, etc., etc. et cetera. But I guess, and one hesitates to invoke such a gruesome comparison, but if we look at the situation of Bosnia in the mid-90s, which was a fractured, inherently fractured country, which ultimately fractured apart, but that was much closer to Europe, much smaller. But in this case, however bad it gets, there is absolutely no prospect, is there, of you know, the EU actually doing anything, or NATO or the UN actually sending people. To an extent, is Ukraine just going to have to sort this out itself?
Well, I think what this situation in Ukraine represents is a perfect storm, if you like, of there aren't any easy solutions, that life is very complicated. Bosnia, in some extent, was more straightforward. I spent some time working there, and there was, whether it's good or bad, a relatively straightforward ethnic divide between the Bosniaks, or the Muslims, the Serbs, and the Croats. But in Ukraine, the situation is much more complicated. It's not a simple ethnic divide. It's not simply those in the West want to be part of Europe and those in the East want to be part of Russia. And the big problem about Ukraine, and this is why I think the EU and the international community has to tread with great care, is that for all their shortcomings and their lack of commitment to freedom of expression, this government was more or less democratically elected. The people on the street are saying, we don't like the way that election turned out.
Which
that
indeed has been said about Yanukovych before by people on the street.
Indeed, although this time, and I have been an election monitor in Ukraine, this time the elections were judged less unfair, if you like, more or less free and fair. I think he probably did get a majority. And the problem is, and it's actually not dissimilar to what's happening in Thailand, is that the masses on the street don't like the way the democratic process turns out, and that's very problematic.
Well, I just want to follow that up and follow up on your experience of having been an election monitor in Ukraine. This is something that news media coverage of a breaking or continuing story like this understandably tends to look past, where the entire media focus is basically on two blocks of downtown Kiev. Now, Ukraine is a huge country geographically and in terms of population. There's 46 million people living in this enormous area. Is it possible to get any sense of how much popular support these people in Independence Square have?
It's very tempting to sit in a studio in London and tell you what the feeling on the street in Kiev is, and I genuinely don't know. What I can say is that the street isn't always right. Now, I am second to none in my defence of freedom of expression and the right of people to demonstrate, and I have demonstrated myself. But it doesn't necessarily mean just because there's lots of them and they feel very strongly that they're right. Now, I'm not defending the Yanukovych government. I'm not close enough to the situation there to know. I'm just saying we have to be very careful, which is why, to pick up Robert's point, I think the international community has found this very difficult because it isn't black and white.
Robert, on a different approach from the international community, how does this look from Moscow? Because on the one hand, this is, to an extent, it's both Putin's worst nightmare, which is people choking the streets of a capital demanding an unpleasant government push off. But it's also, it reinforces what a power player he is in this region, does it not? Russian television, I read, is punctiliously showing the demonstrations from Kiev almost relentlessly by way of demonstrating to the Russian people, you want democracy, it looks like this.
For Putin, this is very serious, because the one thing that he really does stand for is the integrity of the Russian people and the Russian heartland. And this is chipping away at the marches. And there is something about this mentally, spiritually, there's something of Eisenstein and Alexander Nevsky. This is a borderland about it.
It's fair to say Russia will feel far more differently about Ukraine than it would have about the Baltic states, for example.
Yes and no. But there is a similar irredentist element. This is a very interesting. I was teaching class at the Strategic Studies Institute in Exeter only 2 days ago, and I was talking about the power of irredentism, of redeeming some part that you think is integral to your birthright. This is a thing that we in the West, and particularly in the UK, although it's biting us in the metaphorical backside over Scotland, we do not understand it.
We will come to that shortly.
You know, irredentism as a party, as a movement, was invented, obviously, as the word suggests, in the 19th century. By golly, when the wall came down, we completely underestimated that. And the people who underestimated it most, curiously, were the old-fashioned Marxists, people like Eric Hobsbawm. It is vital. I want to pick you up on something, though, about there are no grounds for complacency at any level on this, because you were talking about, oh, well, Bosnia was that, it was relatively simple. What is going on in Sarajevo now? Buildings are burning. People are really, because they don't like the settlement that they've got. Park that one. The other thing that I want to mention, of course, and we must mention it, about the EU and Germany, particularly in the EU, we've got to mention one word, Gazprom. They are utterly dependent, the eastern parts of the EU, Italy even, they are crucially, strategically dependent on gas coming from Russia. And that is the one thing Putin doesn't have to put in tanks. Putin just has to turn the taps off coming across Belarus into the eastern marchlands again, through Poland, through, into Germany, down into Italy. And that is why this is very tense. It's a very tense standoff. The problem is that we see these confrontations in terms of, I think, as Ivan was saying, in the algebra of the Cold War. He and I, colleagues, journalists, have been through that, and we know you've got to bring it up to date. This is a real puzzle. We've had various runs of this before, the crisis over Georgia and so forth. And it's where self-determination right, where civil rights lie, where the rule of the law lies. But the thing that will not work, particularly from the Western media agenda, is megaphone preaching from Brussels, from New York, from and that will automatically draw in the wagons, to mix a metaphor, around Putin. This, I absolutely agree with Ivor, is not a black, white, plus, minus equation at all. And I'm afraid, I'm sorry, I reiterate, it is going to run and run, and nobody holds the decisive card.
Okay, well, we're going to move along to Sochi, where events in Ukraine have also been making an impact, because a few of Ukraine's 44-strong team have withdrawn from competition and returned home. In a possibly related development, the IOC has refused to let those remaining compete wearing black armbands. Yesterday, Sochi was again in the news for reasons Russia would have preferred it wasn't, after film emerged of members of Pussy Riot, who were, of course, released from prison shortly before the Games, being beaten and whipped by Cossacks helping to patrol Sochi. I'll come to you first as a professor of political journalism. Ultimately, given the amount of attention the Games have attracted to some of Russia's less adorable qualities, has it ultimately been good or bad public relations for Russia?
Well, you say ultimately. It's a bit like the man who jumped off the Empire State Building and as he passed the second floor, people said, so far, so good. I mean, I think the beatings, unleashing the Cossacks, goodness me, what a scary word Cossacks is. Mm. Unleashing the Cossacks on Pussy Riots was the start of it all beginning to go perhaps pear-shaped. Up until yesterday, yeah, things were looking good. Britain was winning a massive haul of medals, three, our best ever since 1936.
Better than Australia have managed so far, anyway.
Well, you won the Ashes. We'll pass quickly on that. But has it been good in the short term? Well, apart from the Pussy Riots, yeah, in the long term, I think people looking at Putin, looking at the amount of money spent on the Games, this is the biggest, most expensive Winter or Summer Games. And the Winter Games is much smaller than the Summer Games, and yet more has been spent. And then we look around Russia, a country with huge resources, but a growing disparity between rich and poor. And eventually, whether inside Russia or outside, people perhaps will start asking, was this the best way to spend money? The other thing, and I'll just finish on that, is after the Lord Mayor's show, as we say, does everybody go home and forget Sochi, or do some groups, particularly from the Southern Caucasus and the Northern Caucasus, decide now is a good time to make a show, the security has gone, but people will still recognise the name Sochi?
Come to you, Robert, with, I guess, the same question. Is it a case that when you see extremely unpleasant image, like people dressed up as Cossacks, actually Cossacks, looking like some sort of relic from some 18th century novel, turning on fairly peaceful protesters with bullwhips, is this doubly unfortunate because it plays into a certain idea of Putin's Russia that many onlookers already have?
I don't think it matters to Mr. Putin very much, but I agree that the Cossacks look almost bizarre. I was in Ukraine, actually visited also Sochi, which is the brief bit of Russian coast on the coastline on the Black Sea, just under 2 years ago, and the facilities were being built. And by the way, it should just be said, as Ivar has rightly underlined, it's a very small area, actually, that they put these millions and millions, billions of euros worth of artificial snow and so on. And it's very, very difficult to see what real benefit and return that they will get from that. In Ukraine, there were demonstrations by Cossacks again that in the Crimea, and they look fairly weird. But underneath that, is it sort of Disneyland? Is it actually, as you say, referring to Pushkin, to Tolstoy's early novellas? And it seems very folkloric. But as you were hinting, there is something really rather nasty underneath this. And it's something that actually any sensible observer would say to Putin, it's something that you could do without. But I agree entirely also with Ivar as to what the people who want the caliphate of the North Caucasus are up to. These people, if they may not get it right all the time, they do pretty ghastly things, but they are masters of timing. And I'm sure that the show ain't over there yet. I doubt if they will want to come into Sochi particularly, but they'll do something. It's on the cards if you go back to the various things, Volgograd and so on. It's on the cards. You just look at the rhythm of that. That ain't over. And that will go on for some time.
I want to move along to another story also to do with secession being conducted mercifully, more peacefully. I mean, it has been suggested that also that events in Ukraine could lead to a split or secession there, or even possible amalgamation in Russia. Here in the UK, of course, we have Scotland preparing to vote on independence in September. Ivar, I'll come to you first. The last couple of the big stories of this the last week or so, there's been a fairly robust suggestion by Britain's Chancellor George Osborne that if Scotland leaves the UK, it leaves the pound. There's also been some suggestion that EU membership for an independent Scotland is by no means guaranteed. Has all that served to completely hold the yes case, or do you think this may actually end up being quite close?
If I was being cynical, I would say the pronouncement of David Bowie at last night's Brit Awards, Scotland stay with us, was the key vote changer. But actually, I think, wearing my cephalological hat, I would be, and I'm hostage to fortune here, very, very surprised if the no votes won. The yes have been consistently ahead by significant sums for the last 3 or 4 years.
The no votes, forgive me, upside down.
No to independence. Thank you for pointing that, Robert. They have been consistently ahead. It would be unprecedented in public opinion studies if it was to be reversed and the yes vote was to win. However, I would make the point that I think Alex Salmond and the SNP are very, very canny campaigners. I'm second to none in my admiration for his political skills. He's desperately trying to turn round this issue of the pound, which is going very much against him, because the Scots, as one understands it, had two comfort blankets. Even if we vote for independence, we'll have the pound and we'll be in the EU. Both of those in
and
the
we'll
last
have
week.
The oil, and it's all looking wrong.
Well, the oil's going, and then the pound's going, and the EU's going, and I think it only helps the no campaign.
Notwithstanding what Ivar said there about the polling, Robert, it is noticeable that support for yes to independence is actually up following George Osborne's warning about the pound. Is it arguable that the best thing that the Conservative government of this country could do is just shut up about this until September?
Well, yes, we're back to the Olympic Games, aren't we? When Mr. Cameron tried to embrace the Olympic spirit and ask people of Scots descent like myself who live in England to write in and say, please don't go away. And then Salmond said, well, if you are the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, you should be down in the Somerset Levels. Cameron, Osborne never failed to miscue on this. And at the moment, as Ivar was saying, this is the serious point. The high ground of the argument is very emotional. But if you look at the other stuff, and there's been actually some excellent commentary and journalism on this, people like Bill Keegan, A.M. Heath of the A.M. newspaper, wrote a fantastic piece yesterday in The Telegraph, said, park the politics. How do you do this? And he said that there is, even in the SNP, particularly in the SNP, absolutely fiscal cluelessness about this. But let's just do the simple maxim. The maxim is, how on earth, as Salmond is proposing, do you have a monetary union when you have no political union? And that if they have union with the pound as he wants, he will want voting rights. When it was put to him, then do the Welsh and the English have voting rights on this? He tried that because they're not being consulted. And he is really caught on this. And I agree with Ivor. I think the vote's going to come. The polls are going to go very, very close. And then I think around the beginning of August, they will start to part. Because if it's a pocketbook vote, and I think it will be in the end, there are things that just don't look right. The oil and gas revenue, which they keep on trumpeting, is going down very, very rapidly. By the way, more rapidly than had been projected hitherto.
Robert, thank you for that. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll be discussing the irresistible temptation that rewriting history presents to politicians. You're listening to Midori House.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Professor of Political Journalism Ivor Gaber and the Standards Defence Editor Robert Fox. Now, the ceaselessly quotable British Prime Minister Winston Churchill once quipped that he was sure history would judge him kindly, for he intended to write it himself. The process is more of a struggle for politicians less blessed with a facility for language. Recently, after a long, and many would prefer to think embarrassed, silence, George W. Bush has begun trying to position his legacy. Robert, I'll come to you first. The cue for this discussion is a very interesting article by Maureen Dowd in the International New York Times, who I think has been speaking to Bush on a recent jaunt of his. Is George W. Bush, do you think, doomed to be condemned by history, or is there anything to be said for his legacy at all?
I'm not sure. I think that the negatives are so strong at the moment, and it is the Iraq adventure, ill-gotten, even being questioned about what they chose to do strategically, the strategy employed in Afghanistan. And there are two names that are going to dog and haunt that presidency, and it's Vice President Cheney and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, how he allowed them to run away with them and their Vulcans. That's what's bound to happen. I'd like to sort of go a bit more upstream. It's a terribly good piece by Maureen Dowd, absolutely at her crackling best. And it's triggered by talking to Robert Caro, who's writing this enormous, very well-received biography of Lyndon Baines Johnson. And then she has a conversation with LBJ's daughter, Lucy, who keeps on trying to say, let's forget about Vietnam. And the final point that I had to have to say about Churchill, and this is why he is so terrific, he said, because I intend to write it myself. And by a golly, he did. I mean, he even did things that he just wouldn't get away with now, that he took a lot of the War Cabinet papers such that he could snaffle, and when he was in opposition, and wrote it all up, and furthermore got the Nobel Prize for Literature from it.
Ivor, to come to you, notwithstanding Churchill's efforts in writing history himself, is there anything a president like Bush, or indeed any president, can do to skew how history will view them, or do they just have to take their lumps?
It's interesting, isn't it, that politicians working in the here and now are always thinking, how's history going to remember me? And in general, I think politicians get the history they deserve, so to speak. But it takes time. Just thinking in this country, Harold Wilson, when he left power, was doomed as a hopeless failure, a duplicitous politician, a man who couldn't be trusted. And gradually, as time has moved on, no thanks to his memoirs, which were amongst the worst political memoirs ever conceived.
It sounds like you got further into them than I ever managed.
Well, I got to the dust cover. But the governance of Great Britain, he called it portentous. I always remember that. But that's about all I remember. But nonetheless, history is beginning to reflect back and say, well, actually, he kept Britain out of Vietnam. He steadied the economic ship. He held the Labour Party together, which is always a very difficult achievement. So I think in general, memoirs don't actually have the decisive say.
Absolutely.
I think the judgments of history are probably more sound. Now, just because somebody leaves office in a bad state doesn't mean they're necessarily be resurrected. But nonetheless, many politicians, when Attlee was defeated, British Labour Prime Minister in 1951, he was regarded as a hopeless failure. He is now. You cannot praise him enough.
Heroic. Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Really?
Ivor Gaber and Robert Fox, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Our correspondent Liam Aldous will pay a visit to Madrid's art fair. We'll be assessing Italy's hard power muscle in part three of this week's Italy series. And Fleur MacDonald of The Omnivore will review some of the week's new books. But before we get tucked into all that, here's David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Thank you. European Union foreign ministers have agreed to impose sanctions on Ukraine after the bloodiest day of violence since protests began there late last year. The restrictions include visa bans, the freezing of assets, and restrictions on the export of anti-riot equipment. The EU says the sanctions will apply to those involved with ordering or orchestrating the violence in Kiev. Kiev's health department says 67 people have now died since Tuesday. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has suspended the head of the country's central bank after he raised questions about the whereabouts of $20 billion in oil revenue. Lamido Sanusi made corruption claims during a Senate committee hearing on February the 6th. A hearing in Egypt where 20 journalists are accused of aiding a terrorist organisation has been adjourned until next month. The journalists worked for the Al Jazeera network and are accused of having dealings with the Muslim Brotherhood of former President Mohamed Morsi. Work on the multi-billion dollar Panama Canal expansion is set to restart. A deal's been agreed between canal authorities and a Spanish-led consortium, allowing work to resume while the two sides continue talks on how the project is financed through to completion. Three suspected former guards of the Auschwitz death camp run by the Nazis during World War II have been arrested in Germany. The public prosecutor's office in Stuttgart said the accused are aged 88, 92 and 94 years old. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's now 21:32 in Moscow. That's 18:32 in London, 16:32 in Rio. Now, all this week on Midori House, we've been exploring Italy as it's the theme of the new print edition of Monocle magazine on a good newsstand near you now or shortly. Whether it's current affairs, businesses to watch, cultural highlights, or developments in design that are shaping the Italian nation. Today, however, we turn to its hard power presence. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Dr. Alessio Patalano for an overview of Italy's defence policy. But first, our correspondent Ivan Cavallo takes us on a tour of Italy's brand new aircraft carrier, the Cavar, currently docked in Dubai.
The Cavour is Italy's flagship, so it's a symbol of the country. And on the tour that it's undertaking right now, it's showing off the best the country has in terms of manufacturing, industrial production, whether it's shipbuilding or the various defense systems on board, and showing that off to public officials in various countries who may be interested in buying basically an off-the-shelf aircraft carrier for their navy. This campaign that it was on is part of a promotional tour, so not only are Navy officials from various countries in the Emirates and elsewhere in the Gulf coming on board and looking at the ship and doing a once-over, but they're putting on events with other Italian manufacturers. So you had, for example, Lamborghinis on the deck in Abu Dhabi. I saw in Dubai they had these Maseratis from a local dealership on the flight deck. So it was showing off both, let's say, the hard and soft power of the Italian manufacturing. And it was quite interesting. It was a quite interesting way to promote a country when you're mixing, for example, there are even fashion designers showing off in Abu Dhabi. In Dubai, I saw various furniture manufacturing companies were present as well. So it's interesting kind of blending of manufacturing might that was on display. The Cavour is on, I would say, a 21st century goodwill tour, because besides promoting the military equipment that Italy can make, from helicopters to sea vessels, there were also a campaign with an NGO to provide assistance and operations for children. For example, in Africa, where the ship was headed after Dubai, they were putting on various events and organizing with charity to bring children aboard who had malformities in their mouth, and to do operations that they would stay overnight in a very extensive and quite elaborate hospital facility on board and take care of them. So you had a mixture of the traditional sort of whistle-stop tour of an aircraft carrier pulling into port with sailors going ashore, and you also had a humanitarian side. So I think it's something that you might be seeing more in the coming years as nations try to show off both their hard power and their soft power simultaneously. For an aircraft carrier, I think one has in their mind a very industrial-looking setting. And it's interesting that today on board, for example, in the mess hall, in the canteen, you have an environment that looks a little bit more like a ferry boat. You have a dining room with wood panels. There still is, for the regular sailors, those classic metal trays where they're served their meals. But there are some things that are very 21st century. You had TV was always on with an Italian station. And crews, when they're not on duty, can be in civilian clothes, which is interesting. I was kind of surprised by that. There's a barber shop. Of course, being an Italian aircraft carrier, you have a pizza maker on board. So you get that feeling of being in Italy. There's several bars people can pull up to and have a coffee standing there and chatting away and sipping espresso.
Ivan Cavallo there, and we are joined now, appropriately enough, given that confluence of Italy and water, from Venice by Dr. Alessio Patilano of the Department for War Studies at King's College London. Alessio, first of all, this is Italy's second aircraft carrier after the Giuseppe Garibaldi. What do they need two for?
Well, the first thing to say is that perhaps this is the very first aircraft carrier, because the Garibaldi originally was designed as a through-deck cruiser for conducting ASW operations to keep the sea lanes of the Mediterranean open. This one was conceived ever since day one as a platform that would serve as an aircraft carrier component, and as the program developed, the design was with additional function that went from ASW to command and control functions to humanitarian assistance and disaster relief type of scenarios in mind.
To what extent, and this may seem like a counterintuitive question to ask about what is fairly obviously a big ticket purchase, but to what extent is an aircraft carrier not just a strategic purchase but a symbolic one? To what extent is this Italy saying we're a serious power and a serious country?
I think there is definitely that element in there. I mean, if you are one of the top European countries or within the European context, you want to play an important role politically, strategically. You want to make a statement. You need one of these sort of large floating pieces of kit. We're talking about an asset that is roughly 30,000 tons. At the moment, in fact, it is one of the most modern, carrier within the context of the European Union. So it's an important political statement in that respect.
Italy has just had a change of government, or at least a change of prime minister. Is it too early to tell what kind of things he may want to see Italy do with its aircraft carriers and indeed its wider defence force?
I think one of the issues is that the what we've seen over the past few days with the current reshuffling and the possibility of Matteo Renzi becoming the next prime minister is that it's a clear focus on domestic politics and the sort of economic dimension of the country, consolidated important gains that were set up by the Letta government over the past few months. So I think that in this respect, foreign and security policy will sort of remain at a standstill situation. That being said, the carrier as well as the rest of the fleet is symptomatic of Italy's current legislative commitment, not only in Europe but also in the wider North African and Middle Eastern area. I mean, one should not forget that, for example, Italy has an important role in the anti-piracy mission in the Gulf of Aden and was one of the main contributors to the efforts in the Libyan war in 2011.
Alessio Patilano, many thanks as ever for joining us. And don't forget that tomorrow's instalment of this week's series on Italy will look at the state of its television and media sector. Up next, though, we'll be at Arco Madrid. Stay tuned.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1841 here in London. Spain's annual contemporary art fair, Arco Madrid, kicks off today. Over the next 4 days, 218 galleries from 23 countries will be vying for the attention of collectors, many of whom will have flown in from around the globe. In recent years, the fair has been grappling with the pressures stemming from the country's economic crisis, but this year, a promising selection of big-name galleries, recent changes to Spain's tax regime, and the odd Picasso have been generating some buzz. Talking to both artists and gallery owners, our Liam Aldrus gauged the mood.
I'm at Arco Madrid, where this year everyone is trying to talk positive. Arco director Carlos Urroth has been on a media blitz, talking about the return of optimism and how everyone is keen to put the economic crisis behind them. But with the paintings now hung, the installations positioned, and the gallery staff poised to sell, how much of this is wishful thinking?
I am very optimistic. I don't know the rest of the people. I don't know. It's the first day. We are in the beginning of our. I think it's quite slowly. It's not as the fairs in Miami, Basel, other fairs are very fast because people know if they don't buy very quickly, they lose the piece. Here is more slowly, but it's very interesting. I am happy.
This is Varia Baró from Sao Paulo's Baró Gallery, which is widely considered as one of the go-to galleries for Latin America's emerging artists. Spain has long maintained that it is the European gateway to Latin American art, but more recently, this title is being challenged by cities such as London. Here at the Baró stand, Venezuelan artist Ricardo Acaide believes that strong cultural ties will always give Spain an advantage.
It seems like Spain really have Latin American, you know, culture within the culture of Spanish. So it's, I think it's very, very important. This fair is more, I mean, I think it's the one for Europe to be involved with a Latin American art fair. There's also a lot of very important Latin American artists living in Spain or living in Madrid. I have so many colleagues that they really work here for a long time, and they are a big part of the Spanish art scene, and I think that's is very well mixed, I think.
I pay a visit to one of Spain's most infamous collectors and gallery owners, Helga de Alviar. Today, Helga is in quite a good mood because she's already sold quite a few pieces.
I'm really happy because really the people are interested in the fair. The fair is very good. And you know, Carlos Urroz, the director, he worked with me over 8 years in the gallery. And he's a very good friend of mine. So we all have a helping that the fair will go ahead, and that the good galleries who came one day and they didn't come again because there were nothing to sell here because nobody bought anything, they are coming slowly, but they're coming back. And I see there are really new people, and they are selling, we are selling, and everybody is much more interested, and I'm very happy about that.
Yet the compulsive buy-in, Helga, hasn't been able to resist snapping up some pieces for her own collection.
Yesterday afternoon, I just had a tour around, and I myself have bought already 5 pieces so for my own collection. So you can see that is an illness. To be a collector is an illness, but you cannot do anything. I mean, you have to buy.
Big names are what bring in the crowds, and a Spanish art fair just wouldn't be the same without a Picasso, Dalí or Miró. The Madrid-based Leandro Navarro Gallery has them all. I talked to gallery director Íñigo Navarro about the local market for modern art masters.
Our gallery is dealing since 1978. Then we know where are located some of the masterpieces, like artists like Picasso or Dalí or Miró, Juan Gris, because we are dealing since then these masters. Then some private collections, when they decided to, or they decide to put in the market some of the works, they would like to work with us. At the same time, we have connections with some international galleries, and sometimes we go to auctions, you know, depends on what we are looking for or what sometimes appears. You know.
A few weeks ago, the government announced that it would be reducing the debilitating 21% sales tax on art down to 10%. However, today, gallery owners are reeling from the news that this reduced tax rate will only apply to artists selling directly to buyers. Galleries will instead be slugged by a slightly higher rate of 15.5%. With the Picasso hanging behind me valued at a cool 1.2 million euros, that's a lot of value-added tax. However, an upbeat Íñigo Navarro believes that any change to the previous system is welcome.
It changed absolutely the possibilities to be competitive in our market and, of course, in the European market.
Did this come about as a result of lots of pressure by galleries being put on the government?
Absolutely. We were fighting very, very, very hard from our associations. And I think that finally the government and, of course, Hacienda, you know, the tax government understand that it's really important to be competitive in a European Union, where you can buy very easily a painting in London or in Berlin with a tax absolutely less than before, you know, than the taxes we had before.
The international focus this year is on Finland, and 13 Finnish galleries are representing 13 of the country's contemporaries. Photographer Elina Bruteras is one of them.
Finland is rather far away, you know. We're high up in the north and we're kind of not on the road to somewhere. So we rarely get massive amounts of people coming to Finland. So if we want to get Finnish art to the more general knowledge, we sort of have to get out from Finland. And this is a great opportunity now for Finnish art scene to be presented here in such a big volume, I would say.
Elina is also eager to add to the positivity in the air, talking up the enduring power of art.
Art can be helpful in difficult times. When we think of history, for instance, how much do we know about enterprises and companies and bankers of the Renaissance times, for instance? Well, we do know some, but we know much more artists. So I think art is something that survives difficult times and is the message that is being taken to the future from our times.
Today, the message on the fairground is one of resilience. And judging by this year's more positive outlook, it's a message that is hopefully set to endure for many more years to come. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
Time now for some music here on Midori House, and in tribute to and indeed reflection of the Italian series we've been running all this week. This is Paolo Conte and Azzurro.
Cerco l'estate tutto l'anno e all'improvviso eccola qua. E lei è partita per le spiagge di non avere più risorse senza di te.
Paolo Conte there with Azzurro, not the theme to the Italian edition of The Muppet Show. You're listening to the Midori House here from Midori House on Monocle 24. We are approaching the end of the programme, but before then it's time for our daily review segment where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music, etc. with our correspondents and contributors. Today it's the turn of books and I'm joined by the editor of Omnivore and in that role creator of the Hatchet Job of the Year Award, Fleur MacDonald. Fleur, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk briefly before we move on to hopefully very good books about the art of reviewing an extremely bad book. The Hatchet Job of the Year Award was this year awarded to A.A. Gill for his dispatch of the somewhat lumbering target that was Morrissey's autobiography. What does make a Hatchet Job of the Year? What elevates a merely, by which I mean a bad review, I mean a very good review but a negative one of a book above the common herd?
The simplest answer, I would say, is humour. I think that's what our judges look for first. And then style. You can't criticise a book for bad writing if you're using bad writing yourself.
Yeah, that is true. Actually, it was some consolation once when I got an extremely poor review of one of my books that there was just like this clanging mixed metaphor in the opening sentence of the review. And I just thought, well, I don't have to pay attention to any of this anymore.
Yeah, I hope you didn't carry on reading.
I did carry on reading. He actually had some annoyingly good points beyond that. But nonetheless, terrible mixed metaphor in the first sentence.
But funnily enough, I actually have to add, A.A. Gill, in his speech accepting the award, he talked at length about a terrible review he had of the first book he ever wrote, which still obviously struck a raw nerve.
Yeah, you always remember the bad ones. We will hopefully be talking today about books which, actually, they seem to have been very well reviewed by and large, and so I guess what we're doing is figuring out whether they deserve those good notices. The first one it's not a huge genre, elephant biography. But this is John Sutherland's entry to that, Jumbo.
Yes. I mean, his entry is so wide-ranging, I'm not sure if we need any more elephant biographies. It was excellent, actually. I really enjoyed it. It's not only about Jumbo, who was a
genuine creature who existed.
Exactly. Poor Jumbo was captured in Eritrea in 1861, we learn. His mother's murdered in front of him. And then the rest of his life seems to be a succession of captivity, torture, drunkenness, general unhappiness, and then it ends with his death, which could be, well, there are lots of stories about it, but it could either be a mistake, it could be because he was drunk. Well, he steps in front of a train, that's what happens in 1885 in Canada, this elephant, or it could have been suicide. So it's basically a long account about how to torture an elephant, but done in the most kind of lighthearted and jocular way. It's very strange, actually.
Does that tone work, though? Because it is essentially an extremely sad story, and there seems to be something even sadder than most about bad things happening to elephants for reasons I've never quite comprehended.
Yeah, no, I think they're one of the saddest animals. I think it might be Dumbo. I think that might be
the start of it.
But I mean, I don't think that you could have a very sad book about elephants. Who would want to read that? And John Sutherland is such good company that, you know, I don't think he could write anything that wasn't lighthearted and knowledgeable. There are so many kind of anecdotes that you almost get quite lost. It's sort of, you worry that there are going to be so many witty asides that he's going to give himself whiplash. But I learned some if you read it, you'll learn some incredible things. For example, Thomas Edison, because he wanted to disprove a rival's invention when it came to electricity, he decided that the best way to show how dangerous it was to murder an elephant Topsy on Coney Island and film it.
Well, that's advertising. Crude but effective. Moving seamlessly along, I'm trying to think of a seamless link between elephants and this, but I'm not going to because it's going to go nowhere good. This is Jesse Baring's book Perv, rather provocatively subtitled The Sexual Deviant in All of Us.
Yeah, and it pretty much does what it says on the tin. I mean, it's 300 pages cataloguing every file you could think of. So I think it would be elephantophile if you wanted to link those two.
I'm sure it's a thing. There's probably a website.
But let's not Google that. So, you know, there are, I kind of wrote a list because they're so bizarre. So you can have formicophiles. Do you know what they are in love with?
Have
a guess. Good.
Formic acid.
Actually, so you get one.
Yeah.
What about acrotomophilia?
No, I got nothing.
Amputees.
Okay.
Melissophilia.
I know that because I read while researching this. That's bees, right?
Bees.
That the logistics of that intrigue me. Not enough that I'm going to look it up, but...
Yeah, I don't think it's one to try at home. And I could carry on, as in there are lots and lots of different sexual perversions one can have.
Jesse Baring's a very funny writer, though. Does he try to be funny about this?
Well, I mean, I think that's how you can relate it to Jumbo, actually. Every line seems to be trying to get a laugh out of the reader, which it can get quite tiring, I would say. In the kind of third section, he hardly does. He starts talking about pedophilia, and that's where it gets a bit more serious. I mean, up till then, we hear stories about a woman who's in love with the Eiffel Tower, or people that have orgasms when falling downstairs. We can say that on Monocle, can't we? And lots of kind of fun anecdotes. But it was only until you get to the section about pedophilia that you really have to start kind of taking, I know he tells you not to, but you have to start judging. His point is you can do anything you want as long as you do no harm. And he even suggests that looking at photos of child pornography can actually sometimes be a good thing because it's an outlet for their fantasy. And it's quite difficult to read, I mean, at some points.
At that point, the clock has defeated us. Fleur MacDonald of The Omnivore, thank you very much. You have been listening to Midori House, produced by Alan John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma, studio managed by Alex Funnell. I'm Andrew Muller. Good evening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.